Hello, rap fans. It's Richard Herring here. Thank you for listening to my podcasts, powered by Acast Plus. Do tell your friends if you think they might enjoy them too. And do come and see me on tour in my show, Can I Have My Ball Back? Go to richardherring.com/ballback/tour for all tour dates, going to lots of places in the UK. Some extra gigs added in London at the Leicester Square Theatre and the Bloomsbury Theatre. The Leicester Square Theatre first gig is very nearly sold out, so do rush along to those shows, London, if you want to come along. Some of the shows selling fantastically well, some of them selling pretty badly. Hello, Swindon. Do you know I'm coming to your town? Please buy some tickets. And I do have to give a trigger warning. I've done the show only a few times and 6 men have passed out. After the bit where I explain what happens to you during an operation for testicular cancer. So, are you man enough to handle my balls? Only come if you are, have lots of balls and are not scared of balls. There is some mild testicle trauma involved in this story of testicular cancer. It's mainly funny, though, and if you don't come, that means you're scared to come, and I'm going to judge you, so... It's like going on a fairground ride, so do come along. It's going to be very exciting to see if you make it through. I'll give you a badge if you make it through unscathed. Anyway, come and see the tour, richardherring.com for all that news. Some great Rahalastapas coming up, I have to tell you, in the next few weeks. The tour was a lot of fun. Thanks very much to everyone who came. Sit back, relax, and enjoy my stupid fucking podcast.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hello there, welcome to a bonus Rahalastapa. Rahalastapa, stop saying that, you people over there. Recorded at the Wakefield Theatre Royal. We've got Kay Mellor on this one. It's going to be fun. Look, we're doing loads more Rahalastapas on tour, and we're coming up to the Edinburgh Fringe, where we'll be doing 21 shows between the 2nd and the 25th of August at the Newtown Theatre, every day except Mondays. We've got some fantastic guests lined up. If you go to richardherring.com and click on the picture of me with a stripy jumper on, you'll be able to see all the confirmed guests and also the rest of the tour dates, richardherring.com/gigs or richardherring.com/rahalastapa/tour. Please go to rahalastapa.co.uk and become a badger, and you get lots more extras as well. Let's just listen to the podcast, shall we? Come and see the show. Bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Theatre Royal Wakefield. Please welcome a man who hopes that this first podcast is going to go better than the first one did in Leeds. It's Richard Herring.
Thank you very much. Hello, Wakefield. I dressed up for you. How lovely to be here. Thank you very much. The Theatre Royal Wakefield. This is in the Royal Family in Wakefield. This is where they come to see stuff. This love it down here. Welcome to Richard Herring's Lambasting Suckling Tigers podcast. We're taking a new direction with the podcast, hope you don't mind. There's so much competition now. So what we're going to get, baby tigers... Get them suckling on their mothers and then take the piss out of them. See how it goes. They're wild tigers. They may attack. We'll see. It could be good. Though I was hanging around in Morgana and Hellraiser in the Riding Shopping Centre. I don't go to Primark, mate. I go to Morgana and Hellraisers. And there was a bloke dressed up as a vampire in there and... He called it Rahalastapa, so I don't know if that's going to... That's very good. Thank you very much. Some cool kids in. Wakefield. There's not much I know about Wakefield before today. It is the capital of the rhubarb triangle, which is the worst euphemism for vagina I've ever heard. If you're looking for some rhubarb triangle tonight, apparently outside Argos is a good place to start. So it's this time of night. They love rhubarb. You love rhubarb, don't you? In Wakefield, that's the main thing about Wakefield. They've got a sculpture of some rhubarb. That's how much they like it. There's a Wakefield festival of food, drink and rhubarb, which sort of implies rhubarb isn't a food, which I can go along with. I did mention the Leeds City Varieties. We did. Was anyone at the Leeds City Varieties gig? Yeah, it was quite a lively occasion. We had the first guest was turned up a little bit tired and emotional. It's not going out, but Chet came out of backstage. I think she might be on mushrooms, but apart from that, she's fine. She's going to be fine. She's a bit jet-lagged, apparently, so it'll be fine. Hopefully. What else have I got for you here? Anything? Wakefield is named after... It was Whacker's Field. That's what it's called. There was a lot of people whacking off in the field. They thought, well, better build a town, try and stop them doing that. Now they just do it in the town centre, though, don't they? So it's... Anyway, let's crack on, I think. We're my first guest tonight. Sorry, my only guest tonight. We only do one a week. As you know, I nearly blew it then. He's probably best known as the story editor of episode 100 of Albion Market. That's why we're here tonight. To find out about that. Ladies and gentlemen, will you please welcome Kay Mellor? Welcome. Sit down. Sit down, make yourself at home.
I brought my fam.
You brought your fam?
Yeah, I thought I'd better bring one along. No, but what is it? It's not that I'm pretentious, it's just that I'm menopausal. So that's what it's okay. For. Yeah, just in case I get hot.
Okay. You'll get hot sitting next to me. Look at me in this suit. Have you seen this suit? I don't wear a suit everywhere.
It's nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Especially for you, Kate.
Thank you.
Once Rob's on, he's going to... I'm going to treat you with respect. It's not something
good.
I do very often.
Right.
I don't often have guests that we can respect, really, have done anything worth respecting. So, Albion Market, was that one of your first...
Highlight of my life.
Jobs? Do you remember Albion Market?
Yeah, they axed it, yeah.
You were episode 100.
I was episode 100. They brought me in to save it.
Yeah.
And sadly, I didn't. I couldn't, really. But I tell you what, I learned a lot. Mm-hmm. I learned when something's failing... And the press are against it. You work really, really hard. So, I worked really, really hard, learnt a lot, and they still axed it. It was a shame, really, because it was good.
Yeah.
You know, once we realised that it needed to be about story and not incidents, you know, because it was... There'd be a whole episode about a snake in the market. You know, nobody's interested in a snake in the market. You know, quite they want romance, they want drama.
I'd quite like to see a whole series of just the snake... It's about a snake in a market.
Yeah, that's why you're a comedian.
That's the only character, just the snake.
Yeah, just the snake.
Yeah. I could have turned this thing around for you,
Kate. You could have done. They should have enlisted you.
So, well, let's start. You've lived in Leeds your whole life, is that right?
I have, yeah born
Never
and bred.
Been tempted to... I mean, you've had a lot of big success all over the world.
Yeah.
Never been tempted to move away from Leeds. My only experience of Leeds is meeting Ricky Wilson, so I have I'd have moved straight away if I'd... No, I love Leeds. It's a fantastic city.
Yeah, it's wonderful. It's great. I love it. Yeah. We've got everything. Yeah. You know, we've got Harvey Nichols. We've got, you know, we've got John Lewis.
Yeah.
We've got, you know...
We're in Wakefield. Don't taunt them.
But they come through, don't you? You come through to Leeds. Yeah. They come and visit. Come back, you know, and I come through to Wakefield. Great shopping centre, Wakefield.
Yeah. Lots of empty shops if you're interested in starting up your own business as well.
and they've got John Godber here.
Yeah.
You know, John's wonderful.
Yeah, no, of course. He is wonderful. Your career is quite unusual in that you, especially as in TV. TV's very much seen as this sort of Oxbridge.
Yeah,
I'm very male oriented.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And you got married when you were 16.
I did.
You had a baby when you were 16.
I did. You've done your checking.
I have.
what else are you going to dig up?
Well, because you got married in the year I was born.
Oh, dear.
So I was thinking, yeah. My goodness.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
How, you must have been 11 years old.
Yeah.
But
I
16
was
is
10, actually. No, I was 16.
Yeah, so it's... Yeah. It's that must have been... Did you have aspirations before...
Well, I was the kid. I was the kind of irritating kid in school that does all the plays,
yeah.
Goes to the front of the class and acts out scenes for all the other kids. And that was me, really. Me and Margaret Pickering, good old Yorkshire name.
Yeah.
We would, what is it, we'd act out, do little scenes, and I'd be the one that'd say, you say this, and then I'll say that, and then you say that, and then all they'll all laugh, and then that'd be great, all right? So we'd do that, you know, and we used to do that every time it was raining outside. And so me and Margaret Pickering would entertain all the class.
Right.
And so we got to do it loads and loads of times. And this particular, so we started doing it even when it wasn't raining outside.
Right.
And this particular day, I remember class all clapped at the end of the session, and then somebody kept on clapping. And it was the teacher, and we thought, oh, no, now we're going to get done because it's not raining outside, you know. So all the kids scooted off. And she said, you two wait behind. And I'm busy saying to Margaret Pickering, it's your fault. And she's going, no, like this, you know, who's going to be the one that takes the blame? And she said, OK, which one of you makes up the stories? And Margaret went like that to me. And I went, it's me. And she went, I remember this. She said, I wish I could take you back to the States with me. I wish I could put you in my pocket. And I had no idea what that meant. And I remember just saying, am I in trouble? And she said, no, just go on out. And after that, I was always invited to any arts things that were on, you know, in yeah. school, like the ballet and stuff like that. I got herded along, you know, with the rest. So I would, you know, so I'd be in year three and it'd be for year four, but I'd be asked to go along.
Yeah.
So she recognised something in me.
But did you think at that point that that was a career? Because I
No. You know, for me, as a girl, you know, the best that I could achieve, that I thought, would be to be a teacher or a nurse, and that was it. Yeah. I didn't know what writing was. I didn't know what a writer or an actor or a producer was. So I had no idea. I didn't come from those circles. You know, I was, you know, on the council estate, Islandwood Council Estate, and that was it.
Yeah.
That was my lot. If I was very, very lucky, I could be a teacher or a nurse.
And so what prompted you? Obviously, you had children young, and then when you were a bit older, you went back to university or college to do drama.
Yeah, I did.
And so what prompted that move?
Well, I promised my mum. I remember after she found out I was pregnant, I remember saying, oh, you know, you're so clever, Kay, she said to me. It's just such a shame that, you know, it felt like I'd ruined my life, you know, because that was back then. And, you know, she said, you could have done anything, you know. And she said, will you promise me one thing, which is that you'll go back into education later on, that, you know, if you get chance?
Yeah.
And I said, yeah, I will. And so when my kids started school, I was still only, oh, I don't know, in early 20s.
Yeah.
So I went back and started doing O-levels and A-levels, all the things, you know, and I found it absolutely fascinating. I absolutely loved it. And then I thought, what am I going to do with all these O-levels and A-levels? I got loads of them by that time. And somebody said to me, why don't you go to Bretton Hall? And I said, where's Bretton Hall? And they went, it's in Wakefield. And so I went, yeah, okay, I can do that, you know, let me try. So I went for what was it, like an interview / audition.
Yeah.
And they said, fill in this form, tick anything that you're interested in. So I ticked everything, pottery, you know, English, the arts, everything. There were about 8 of them, things that I ticked. And then this tutor came out and he said, who was it that picked 8? Things, you know, and so we're all queued up and I went, oh, well, you know, put my hand up and he went, we'll start with drama and then we'll move along. And then after the drama, they just said, this is what you should be doing. You should be doing drama. And I loved it. I just loved it. I thought, I landed at Bretton Hall in October and literally, you know, all the autumnal leaves and the sky and there was a boating lake. I thought I'd landed in paradise. You know? And they were paying me then.
Yeah.
They paid me.
Well,
you don't get that now.
No.
To go and study.
Yeah.
Now, you know, we have to pay for it. And without that, I wouldn't be able to be a student.
It's sort of interesting because I think, like, both as a writer and a student, the things I regret about being a student is you sort of, you know, you're a teenager, early 20s.
Yeah.
And so you don't really do any studying because I was trying to have sex, you know. Yeah. I was nearly 20 before I had sex, so I wasn't going to have children at 16, unfortunately. Yeah. But as a writer too, that, you know, I've actually now got two young kids under four.
Yeah.
That's a pain in the ass when you're 52, isn't it? That's... If I'd done it, if I could have found someone to have sex with me at 16 and got them pregnant, I could have got that out of the way.
You could have done it. And had a career.
Yeah. Shut up.
Sorry.
No, it's all right. You're allowed.
Payback time.
Long as the gloves are off, Kay. And so you started as an actor, and then how did the writing come? Did the writing come out of doing?
Well, the writing started really at Breton,
right?
At Breton Hall, because God, I'm gonna have to take this off just a second.
Sexual magnetism. It's when I started talking about losing my virginity at nearly 20. That was
the
difference.
It's made me hot.
Ow. I was saying, I was holding on to it for someone special.
I'm here.
Yeah. So the writing came out.
Breton Hall, it was the NSDF, which was National Students Drama Festival, and usually it was at Oxford or Cambridge, but this particular year it was at Breton Hall.
Right.
And I thought, I could do a play, I can do that. So I worked with a couple of actors downstairs in the it was like a sacred place. It was like a prayer room or something, and we made this play called Paul. When I say made it, it was sort of semi improvised, and then at the NSDF. So we improvised it, and then I shaped the play and made it into a proper play, you know, and typed it all up and everything, and then we put it on, and we were, you know, we won Best New Play, which was fantastic, and I had people like, you know, James Fenton and Bill Alexander from the RSC asking me how I did it. Right. I remember going like, what have I done? I had no idea what I'd done, you know, that I'd created this play. And then people started saying, oh, you should do that. But at the same time, I was acting in things like Twelfth Night and playing Viola, playing all the leads, Antigone and, Rosalind. And so I loved acting and I loved writing. And I just felt wonderful. It was the most wonderful creative time of my life when I was at Breton Hall. And then when I finished, I didn't know really what I wanted to do, so I formed a theatre company. And we used to tour around places like this, you know, and we'd chat, you know, I'd put the play on and I'd be in it, write it, do everything, you know, direct it. And then we'd pull up our chairs and talk to the audience. And the audience, you know, Yorkshire audiences are very straight.
They are.
And they'll tell you if they like something, and they'll tell you if they don't.
They told Ricky Wilson.
Yeah. Well, that's it. Yeah. You know, that's what you want. But you learn a lot from that. Ricky would have learned a lot if he'd listened.
If he could only have remembered any of it.
So that's where the writing started.
But it's sort of getting on with it, isn't it? I think the thing... Because a lot of people email me, and I'm sure lots of people email you and say, how do I become a writer? And you kind of go, well, you're sort of prevaricating now by even asking
do
the
it.
Question. You can write something. Go and write something and put it on somewhere and do it.
And people say to me, how do you write television? And I go, hang on, you've got the best tool in your living room. Right there. You can look at it and watch and see how to write television. You know, what's your favourite programme? And, you know, analyse it, watch it again, write down how many scenes are in it, see how a scene is constructed, see how many characters that you use, you know. It's not like it's a mystery. It's right there in your living room.
Yeah, but it's still, like, it's such an amazing story, even by, you know, to get to the level of success you've got from that beginning in, you know, in Yorkshire, young mother...
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, but it is, you know, because I'm from Yorkshire too, so I'm in a way an amazing success as well.
Yes, no, he isn't.
I got out quick. Yeah. I got out when I was four. But you know, it's so extraordinary. People, and I mean, I do want to talk about this now, but it's because at the moment, you know, there's all this... controversy about how many women writers there are on TV, and it's still something like 10 or 12% of scripts are written by women. And that, you are in the 80s and 90s, you know, creating these massive drama series for ITV and BBC.
Yeah. I think it was hard. I've got a very kind of persistent streak. If I believe in something, I'll really, really push it, you know. It's like I started to go to award ceremonies and places where I knew that Alan Yentob was just so that I could get to him. And I would see the look of fear in his eyes. He'd go, it's that mad woman coming to me again to get me to read that bloody script, you know. And because he had the script, he had the first script of Band of Gold.
Right.
And, you know, I wanted him to read it. That's all I wanted him to do. But you know, looking back, it was a northern woman, and he, you know, writing about sex workers. Yeah. He ain't going to read that script. I know that now, you know. But now, because I've got a bit of a name, now anybody would read a script that I put in, you know. Yeah. But then going back, you know, it was difficult because he would be, you know, hobnobbing with the likes of Simon Gray, Oxbridge, Cambridge people. And I was nobody and a nothing. So it was really hard. And it was actually through knowing somebody, through Albion Market, actually, that comes back. And he's a Huddersfield lad called David Liddiman, who happened to be working at Granada Television. And I got into Granada through acting. So I went to play a policewoman in Albion Market, funnily enough. Yeah. And so I played the copper in that for about 5 or 6 episodes. Then I had a week off and I wrote an episode of Albion Market.
Right.
And then I thought, what am I going to do with this? Shoved it in the envelope and wrote on the front of it, the producer, no idea who his name was, and left it at the front desk. 3 weeks later, I got a call from Bill Podmore. Anybody remember Bill Podmore?
Yeah.
He was the executive producer for a long time of Coronation Street. He was also the exec for Albion Market, and he asked me to come in. And he said, oh, I've read this script. He said, and I really like it. Will you come in and meet me, meet the team? And I remember going, oh, my God, what does a writer wear? That was the only thing I could think of, you know, because I was an actor, really.
Yeah.
So I bought a trouser suit. I'll look butch.
I mean, people are on the lookout for writers. Well, the sort of writing isn't something you can really, you know, wing and get away with, as I've discovered in my career. I've tried my best, but they expect you to work hard. And, you know, there's a lot of people writing, I guess, who are sending in bad scripts. So when good scripts come in, they're quite a rarity. You know,
So
people, it's great that that could happen in that way.
Yeah, it was lovely. It was fantastic that somebody read it.
Yeah.
That's half the problem, you know, getting somebody to read it that understands and recognises a good script. Because that's not always the case.
No.
You know, it can be so difficult and so frustrating.
Yeah.
And, you know, to this day, sometimes I feel that I've got to fight a battle. I'm still kind of, you know, I go, no, you know, he's not really dead. You know, he's not really a ghost. I hear myself saying, well, sort of is a ghost. You know? But I'll say slightly supernatural.
Yeah.
You know, but and I'm kind of going, why don't you just let me make it and then you can see it?
Yeah, that's my philosophy. I refuse to show them anything I've done. And early on as well, which I didn't know until today, you wrote for Dramarama, which I remember.
I did.
And I was a bit too old to be watching that. And also you created Children's Ward, which was...
I did. Paul Abbott and myself created Children's Ward. We loved that.
Yeah.
Paul and I, wrote Shameless and many, many wonderful things that he's written. We did. We were both storyliners for a time on Coronation Street, and we used to do it really quickly, shove it in the drawer and go, and then pull out our own work,
right.
You know, and kind of, we had typewriters then.
Yeah.
You know, we put the paper in and we, you know, wind it round and we dream up this idea of, you know, a children's hospital. And, you know, I'd have a character, say, my character would be Keely, and he'd take on Billy, and we'd there chat and talk about it. And when I read the scripts now, to this day, they're good. They were good scripts.
Yeah.
And we managed to deal with all sorts of, like, you know, young people's problems. And we didn't do it for that reason. We just thought it's great drama.
Yeah.
You know, and it went on for 12 series and won a BAFTA and everything.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was a good thing to do, really.
Well, people still remember that.
Yeah, they do.
I think from around that time was that, and Press Gang was another sort of very grown-up kids series. And you know, we'd
treat kids like adults. We didn't write down for them. We just wrote the best drama that we could.
Yeah.
And hence it's going on for 12 years, I think.
And people still remembering it and cheering in the background.
Yeah, yeah. It's nice.
You're going to bring it back, Children's Ward?
Oh, well, you never know.
And so with the act, you're obviously doing this acting. You're successful as an actor as well, and you still do bits and pieces of acting.
I do.
But was there a choice to go more down the writing route as that became more successful?
I think what happened when I got offered I'll Be in Market, I also got offered a part on Emmerdale. I can't remember that. I think Kate Dove played the part, so it was a woman like in her late 30s, early 40s. And I remember thinking, well, it's just a part, you know, and I can pick that up and run with it later. Yeah. But right now, I didn't know any other female writers as such, not in drama. I knew in comedy there were a couple dotting about. And I thought, I'm going to do this. And I really thought that I had to make a choice. You know, unlike somebody like, you know, Phoebe Waller-Bridge, you know, who can now just run with it, and you kind of go like, you know, just do your own thing. And I think it's wonderful that there are actors around, you know, Miranda Hart, etc., who writes and acts in her own stuff. Because I would have loved to have done that.
Yeah. Would you didn't feel it was an option, or you just...
Not back then. No. I mean, I've done bits and pieces. You know, I did a stage play called Queen at the West Yorkshire Playhouse that I wrote and acted in, and I'd like to bring that back at some point.
Yeah. Well, let's go to Band. I mean, the thing with Band of Gold is it is such a bold idea, again, especially at the time, I think.
Well, I was actually walking, you know, well, I was driving to a party, actually, in Bradford, and we were driving up Lum Lane, and this young girl, I could see her in the distance, I thought, oh, you know, this is the red light district, and then this young girl bobbed down to look in our car as it passed by, and you know, it was just literally felt as though somebody had punched me in the solar plexus because she was so young. Yeah. She was the age of my daughters. And I thought, what on earth is she doing out? It was November night. Her legs were like blue with the cold. And we went to this party and I said to Anthony, it was on my mind the whole time. And I went, can we go back the same way as we came, you know, when we were driving home? And I went to look for her and couldn't find her. So I stopped another woman that was a sex worker. And I said, there was a young girl, had blonde hair. And I said, she was only very, very young. She went, oh, that'd be Tracy. She said, oh, that'd be Tracy. She's got pimp problems. She's gone to work in Nottingham. And that's it. And I never found her that girl again. But the character was born in my head.
Yeah.
It depressed me. It depressed me that young girls like that were out on the street, you know, working as sex workers. I remember thinking, we should be doing something about that. You know, somebody should do something. And then I thought, I know what I'll do. I'll write it. The best thing to do is write something and make it, bring an awareness that actually these are not just, you know, prostitutes, inverted comma, or sex workers. They're actually women first. Because we put a label on people so easily these days. So that's what I did, really. Yeah. I called it Band of Gold because somebody said it was a good name.
It's a good name.
Yeah.
Well, I wish I'd been, because the only acting roles I ever get now are people, perverts, who go to prostitutes. So if you could bring...
You could be in my play.
Yeah, well, if you've got anything for that. Yeah. I don't know why I'm the most vanilla, boring person in the world. Well, look at me, you wouldn't know it now, looking at me all dressed up for you, all smart. But, I'm very good at perverts.
Are you?
Yeah.
No, for some reason, seriously. Even though do you want to act? Because I'm doing Band of Gold at the Grand Theatre.
Okay.
And we're looking for somebody that's a pervert.
Finally, this fucking thing's paid off.
Yeah.
Finally, I got a fucking job out of it.
Would you come and see it if it was in it?
Great.
There you go.
Cool.
We'll sign you up.
It's literally that easy. If only I'd known. Oh, dear. There's lots to talk. I mean, there's so much to talk about. I'm very annoyed about Fat Friends, I have to say.
Oh, what are you annoyed about?
Because I had the same idea and it was in development and then that came along.
Oh, no, really?
And then that was the end of that. So thanks a lot.
I killed you all.
Thanks a lot. I was sort of amazed nobody had done it and I think you were probably working on it when I had the idea. Because I was sort of very early days and then it was stamped on.
Yeah.
by you doing it brilliantly. I think you did it better than I would. But it's sort of spotting those situations,
isn't it? Yeah. It's just ordinary people in a kind of slightly extraordinary circumstances. That's all it is, really.
Yeah.
That's what I'm known for, really, I suppose.
Yeah.
And around me, wherever I went, people were on a diet.
Right.
Everybody I saw was on a diet. Friends, family. They either wanted to lose 7 pounds or they wanted to lose 7 stones. You know, it was just everywhere. And I thought, what is wrong with people? You know, why don't you just accept yourself for who you are? And then I thought, I'll do a little bit of research. So I thought, I'll join a slimming group and get a bit of inside stuff. So I thought, yeah, there's one at my local kind of church hall. And I shan't mention the name of the slimming club. But I thought, I'll go along. And I thought, how can I keep going? Because I need to kind of meet the characters and get to know them. But I thought, I know what I'll do. I could put some heavy things in my pockets and, you know, and I might have to lose half a stone or something like that. So that's what I did. And I went along and I'm going, yes, sign my registration form and everything. And she went, okay, right, moving along and moving along. Okay, step up on the scales. So I stood on the scales thinking, oh, it'd be about 4 or 5 pounds, I bet. So she went, okay. She said, well, we'll start half a stone at a time. She said to me. And I went, look down like that. I went, oh, my God, when did that happen? Literally. Yeah. Because I just didn't know. I used to think, you know, I used to kind of say things like, Marks and Spencer's tights have got smaller, you know. Or this has shrunk in the wash. This linen has really shrunk, you know. I didn't know it was happening to me because I'm not that aware. I'm not that body aware. I'm a kind of cerebral person. I'm not really like that. So I'm going, sudden shock. I wasn't interested in the television programme anymore. All I wanted to do was lose weight. That's all I wanted to do.
Yeah.
And then I got into it. Oh, my God, I was so disciplined. These sins, that sins, you know. And I became quite preachy about it. So it was quite good because I went both sides.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? I became like, you know, stick insect, the woman that ran ran the group. And I was sat the other side kind of being humiliated and people, you know, everybody that had lost weight that week stood up and was all applauded, you know, and then those people that put weight on were all named and shamed, you know, how much you'd actually put back on. And I thought, God, this is incredible, this is, you know. And it was funny.
Yeah.
It was really funny. So I thought to myself, it was dramatic and funny. So I thought, yeah, I've got this. And then I pitched it at ITV and they bit my hand off. So,
I said, we've got something like that in development. We'll do yours.
But you're a much better writer. Yeah.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
It is by well, I'm fat. I go up and down with weight all the time. I've lost a little bit this year.
Oh, well done.
But it sort of is fascinating that the way that you know, people keep going back to those things. And I did Weight Watch. I did a Weight Watchers group with Julie Sawala and her family. When I was going out with Julie Sawala, it wasn't.
Oh.
So they came around a private little thing and they did a Weight Watchers group with us. It was very surreal.
Literally, they came to your house.
They came to her house. Yeah, they come to
I'd like
house.
That to happen to me. Yeah. Actually, how do you get in touch with them? You know,
but you lose weight and then you lose
you
interest, and then you put it back on a bit more on, and then
So you put it more on,
go back and forth.
So I turned it into a musical now.
Yes,
and there's been touring. They've toured all around the country, and I loved that. So it gives it another life.
Sure.
You know, it was really great. And I learned such a lot. It was brilliant to learn something completely new about music. You know, Nick Lloyd Webber did the music. That was brilliant, you know, for me to learn and for him to, you know, I suppose, break out from underneath his dad's wings, really, in a way.
Yeah.
Really good.
Is that ongoing still, or is that...
Well, we're going to tour it again.
Yeah.
So we did a big national tour, huge. It went on forever and ever. And then we stopped, and then... because we're doing Band of Gold now, and then we'll go back. And I think it's 2020 that we're going to do another big Christmas show and tour that round.
That's great that you've got this kind of extra life to...
Oh, it's lovely to see it. And then people come to see it because they want the characters. You know, they love those characters. You know, they loved Kelly and Kevin and Betty and Douglas. You know, and they don't, you know... They don't die, because that's the trouble with television. It is so kind of, you write the characters, you put it on, and it's all done and dusted in 6 weeks.
Yeah.
But it's lovely to think that actually the characters will live again. And, you know, and they get to sing as well, you know, so it's nice.
Did you find that, is that the first time you've written songs?
Yeah, and I didn't know that I could. I really didn't know. So I just literally wrote something a bit like a poem, only with the characters and the feelings in it. And then Nick took the poem / song and then put music to it.
Yeah.
And I go like, oh my God, I wrote that. You know,
it was... What's terrifying about you is basically anything you go, I'll have a go at that. Oh yeah, I'm really good at it. Yeah, I'll have a go. Oh no, I've never thought of doing that. I'll give that a go. Yeah, I can play badminton, it turns out. Yeah, I'm brilliant. I'm world champion badminton player.
I'm bad at a lot of things, trust me. Really bad.
Oh, it's cool. There was an amazing cast with Fat Friends, and you got a lot of the people right near the beginning, really. I mean,
did.
Corden and...
Yeah.
Was Ruth Jones in
there? Ruth Jones, yeah. And it was great because it was funny because I genuinely wanted big people.
Yeah.
And actors used to come in and they'd go, and I go to them, you know, how much do you weigh? And, you know, you wouldn't be allowed to say that now. And they go, I'm 10.5 stone, you know. Like, it was gross. And I go, no, I'm looking for somebody more like 18 stone. And it was so pleasurable for me to say that, you know. And people would come in and they'd be padded up and stuff.
Yeah.
But Ruth and James were the real McCoy.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'd seen James on a little tiny advert where he played the tango boy, literally. Right. And he was, like, in the background. Supping a can of Coke, and I remember ringing Beverly Doyle, who was my Keogh, who was my casting director back then, and I said, "There's a lad, and he's in an advert." And she went, "I'll find him." I said, "He's got ginger hair, and he's really chubby." And she found him for me. I was in London. I was actually at the Groucho Club, and this lad comes stumbling in, and I thought, "That's him," because she'd been in touch with the. Managed to find him.
Yeah.
And he literally came running over to me and got down on his knees and he said, please give me this part. Please give me, it's me, Kay, it's me. I've battled all my life with weight and his dad had gone away to serve in Iraq or something like that. And he went, I want this part, I want it. And I looked at him and I thought, well, you're perfect for it, actually, if you can act.
Yeah.
That's it, it's yours. And so I took him over to Spotlight. And he auditioned, and the rest is history.
It's a bit like meeting me and just thinking I'd be the kind of bloke who visit prostitutes, isn't it?
Yeah, same, exactly.
Same thing.
You don't know where it could end.
I better go to some prostitutes just to get some... I better... Apparently there's some in Wakefield. So it's... apparently there's some... Oh dear! I'm going to ask a couple of emergency questions, then we'll get back because there's a lot to talk to you about. But people,
well, you're getting a proper book out
now. There's a proper book of emergency questions. It'll be available in the foyer after the show. the problem is I don't want to ask any of these disgraceful questions that I've written. I'm not going to ask any of those ones. I'll go early because you know these people in the suburbs they like to get the early ones. Suburbs. Yeah, no, nowhere near the suburbs. What am I talking about? Have you ever seen a ghost?
Oh, I suppose it. Funnily enough, we were talking about surreal things, weren't we?
Yeah.
It's a weird thing, But on the day, I'm going to sound like I'm bragging now, and I'm not. But on the day that I got my, I found out that I'd been awarded an OBE, I was in my kitchen, and I looked up, and I looked out of the window, and I saw my mum, who'd passed away, sadly, like 10 years earlier. And I saw my mum as a young woman, just fleetingly for a minute, for a second. And so the day that I found out that I'd got my OBE was literally the day I saw a ghost, which was the ghost of my mum, which was absolutely extraordinary. And it was the most lovely feeling for me. Yeah. It was the most warm, lovely feeling to see my mum young and happy.
Yeah.
Really smiling at me.
But she'd been waiting until you got an OBE before she came back. They wait 10 years. Come on, do something. All right.
I felt as though she was kind of, I don't know, maybe it was me thinking I wish my mum was here to tell her. Do you know what I mean? I didn't know which way around it was. And I didn't tell anybody because I thought that I'd be carted off. I'll never get my OBE. I'll be in some lunatic asylum, you know.
But, you wrote a play about your mum, didn't you?
I did. Passionate Woman. That was on at West Yorkshire Playhouse.
Yeah.
Yeah, she came. Yeah, she told me this thing. It was extraordinary. So one day, I was in my middle 30s, and we were washing up and drying up. I'd been around to her house. It was Wednesday. And I'd fallen out with my husband, Anthony, over some trivial thing. And she started telling me about a time when her and my dad were having a bad time. And then she went on to tell me that she'd had an affair with a man. And putting the pots away and everything, listening to this. And then she said, and I said, oh, so what happened to him? She went, oh, he got murdered. God, right. She's his name was Craze. And he got murdered in the fairground. I went, right, okay. I said, oh, that must have been a shock for you. And she said, yeah. She said, I really, really loved him. Which, for my mother to mention a man and love in the same sentence was remarkable, because she was quite a feminist in her own way. And I realised that she was crying. I'd never seen my mother cry ever. And I just put my arms round her and hugged her. And I went, it's all right, Mum, it's all right. She said, I've never told anybody. This was over 30 years, she'd never told a soul. And I went, don't worry, I'll never tell anybody, Mum. cut to 10 years later, and I didn't tell anybody for 10 years. Cut to 10 years later, my little brother was getting married. My mother loved her children, absolutely adored them, particularly loved my little brother. Anyway, he's getting married, and she's beside herself. And I went, Mum, you know, he's got to get married at some point. He's pushing 30, you know. And I said, it's not a bad thing, you know. It's a good thing. It's a good thing, you know. And she said, oh, I just wish I could crawl somewhere and die. She went, I really do. And I went, oh, for goodness sake. But I remember thinking about this extraordinary thing that she'd said. And I thought, somebody crawling somewhere to. So I put the two things together, this man, and on the day of my brother's wedding, and came up with A Passionate Woman. Rehearsed it, put it on at the West Yorkshire Playhouse, and I thought, God, I better let my mum have a look at this. So, preview, my mother sat there, me and her, a few others, people, not many. We watched it, and then afterwards I turned to look at her, nothing. She went, oh, I quite like that. I went, oh, good, thank God for that. 4 days later, she said to me, can I go see it again? I went, yeah, you can go and see it again. She went to see it again. And then she turned to me and she went, this is about me. I know what you've done. She went, it's about me, about what I told you. And I said, yes, but Mum, I know that. You know that. Nobody else knows that. So it's all right. And I'm never going to tell anybody. I went, and you're not ever going to tell anybody. So nobody will ever know. Cut to press night. All the audience, all the press, you know, Daily Mail, Mirror, all the press that you could think of, Yorkshire Post, Yorkshire Evening Post, Wakefield, blah, blah, blah. Everybody there, plus it's absolutely heaving. Put the play on. Everybody loved it. We bring our chairs forward afterwards, questions from the press and that, and they're all saying to me, oh, it's a lovely play, okay, blah, 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 blah. Seems really personal, and I'm kind of going, well, it is really personal, but. And they go, who is it based on? I'm going, oh, well, you know, it's not really just one person, you know, sort of trying to prevaricate, etc. And then from the audience, my mum goes, it was me! So all the press turned. microphones under my mother's face. She goes, well, it was a long time ago and I had an affair. He was a lovely man. No. And then she goes into deeply personal things. And so I'm sure they're going, oh, my God. You know, and that was it. That was my mother's coming out, really, in a way. But what was wonderful about it was actually that she had no shame then. It'd gone, you know. I think in a way I'd exercised it for her by seeing it on the stage. She realised it wasn't a bad thing that she did. She was in a very unhappy marriage with my father and found, you know, love, whatever you want to call it. I mean, she still remembered him 30 years later. A very passionate affair she had with him. He lived above her in the flats in Sheepscoe in Leeds. So that was the story of a passionate woman. And then it went on to the West End. Ned Sheeran directed it. And so my mother came to that first night, you know. So then it became, like, national, really. And she still, you know, she still said it was her story and she was happy to own it.
Yeah. I mean, I think people, if the thing's good as well, especially, it's people like to be written about. On the whole, not everyone, I think. Are you conscious of that? Because obviously you use a lot of things from your own life, even if you're changing them and messing around with them. Is that a concern as a writer? Because I'm writing my recent thing is sort of about my family, most of whom like it and one of whom really didn't like it.
It's difficult.
It's quite a difficult line to, you know, even if you think, oh, I'm being really respectful and...
Yeah.
Do you worry about that or do you feel you...
I don't. No. No, I just kind of... I think a writer has to write what they want to.
Yeah.
You know, what's in them, what they feel. And, you know... It was like my mum told me that story. There was no way that I couldn't kind of share it with people because it was such a wonderful story. When I came out of the stage door when we put it on in the West End in London, literally as far as I could see were women all saying, "That's my story. That happened to me." And literally Stephanie Cole, who played Betty, was mobbed, right. You know, because people just wanted, you know. They felt kind of, I don't know, as though that they were redeemed, really.
Yeah.
You know, it was the most lovely experience. And Stephanie looked at me, she went, who would have thought that it would have touched a nerve like that, you know?
It's interesting, though, isn't it? Because that happens again a lot with things. You write something and then people go, that's happened to me.
It makes
you realise kind of how similar people's experiences are. I mean, we do. Yeah. I think that's the thing with in writing and in comedy, you're sort of trying to reveal a truth. And most of us in our lives are trying to hide all the truths away, aren't we?
And then when suddenly you reveal a truth, people go, oh, it's all right. I feel all right now because of this. I feel like normal, really, because you feel, you know, you can walk around feeling like a freak or feeling like, you know, that you're the only one that happened, and it's quite isolating when you feel that you're the only one that this has happened to.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And so, like, well, I'll talk a bit about the writing process, just this is for myself, in an attempt. I'm trying to take notes so that I can be a better writer. I don't suppose you get many scripts turned down anymore, but...
Yeah, you'd be surprised. Yes, you do. I do.
Because I find the difficult thing about being a writer, you've got to invest so much in writing a script that when it doesn't happen or something goes wrong, it's sort of like... I mean, it's not quite the same as having something happen to your children, but it's a horrible...
Yeah, because
you've put so much into it.
You nurture it, you cosset it, you protect it, you know, it is your baby. Yeah. It is, you know, and you love it. You love it, and you share it with somebody. And if they go, no, thanks, not for us. That's like you taking your child to school and the teacher going, he's a bad boy. We don't want him at our school. Yeah. That's what it feels like. It's really painful. I don't get it so much, but it still happens to me. Yeah. I mean, recently I had a script knocked back, which was... I'd written a script. The commissioner had said that she wanted that script. That was what was... You know, she wanted, we went away very happy. I thought I knew what she wanted. And then higher up, somebody said, oh, I don't like things that have got a paranormal feeling to it.
Right.
And so I thought, okay, I'll take the script back. It's my script.
Yeah.
And I shall protect it and love it and I shall take it elsewhere. I'll take it to a different school.
Yeah.
That's what I thought.
And is that... But if it doesn't happen... I mean, I guess you've got your own production company. You can get things off the ground, I suppose. But do you mourn that script or do you just let it go?
No, you've got to believe in it.
Yeah.
You've got to love it. You have to... You know, Band of Gold didn't just happen. You know, a lot of, you know, BBC let it go. The BBC let it go. You know, I used to write to people saying, please, will you read my script? Please, will you read it? Nobody would read it. And if they read it, they weren't interested. Literally, because of the subject matter, what it was about. It took somebody brave at ITV to go, I get this, I know it, I understand it, and I think the audience will get it too. Mm. You know, but yeah, there were at least two or three knockbacks before ever it got put on. And if I'd have lost faith in it, it would have just, you know, been in some draw. And we would never have had, you know, Band of Gold on screen. And, you know, people like Russell T Davies, gorgeous man that he is, you know, he said, I would have if you hadn't have written Band of Gold, Kay, I could have never written Queer as Folk.
Yeah.
And you can't, you know.
Yeah.
So it has a knock-on effect.
Sure.
You know, drama moves on because, you know, and then Queer as Folk happens, and because of that, something else will happen. But you've just got to be brave, and you've got to believe in it, and you've got to knock on doors, and you've got to be focused and love it. It's like letting your kid go.
Yeah.
If you let your kid go, you know, you think you don't care where they've gone, then that kid's not going to come. Well, they might come back. I don't know, but they might come back when they're hungry.
Yeah, they keep coming back.
Yeah.
I tried to get rid of them. And what's the quickest you've ever written a script from start to finish? Because I sense that you work very hard at your scripts, obviously, and yeah. you're quite a planner, I think, by the sounds of what I've read yeah. about you. Have you ever written one very quickly?
I think I've had one commissioned very quickly.
Yeah.
I mean, The Syndicate was commissioned very quickly.
Right.
I pitched it, and by the time I got in the cab to the train station, it'd been commissioned, which was pretty quick.
Yeah.
But writing-wise, soaps, Brookside...
Yeah.
Literally, you and Coronation Street, you would have very short time to turn it round.
Right.
So maybe a week,
right.
You know, you'd write a script. But you, I mean, I used to be awake, literally. I used to, you know, write through the night and stuff like that. I remember one morning going to my laptop in the study and going, oh, I'll just write this scene. You know, I've got my dressing gown on, I've been in the shower, nothing. Sat there writing this scene. I thought, I'll just finish this scene and then I'll get in the shower and have my breakfast. And there I was writing. And then I heard the door go downstairs and I kind of went, hello, like that. And then I went to, because I used to write upstairs, went to the banister, looked over and I went, Anthony, my husband, was home. I went, what are you doing home at this time? And he said, it's 6 o'clock. And so I'd sat. I mean, it can't be good for you either. I'd literally sat from 9 o'clock in the morning till 6 o'clock, and I didn't know.
No.
I hadn't eaten, I hadn't had a cup of tea, I hadn't done anything, I hadn't got up and walked about, meant no wonder I had a weight problem. You know, I mean, literally just, you know, bum to see, brain to thing. Because I was so engrossed in what I was writing. And you had to have the script in.
Yeah.
Script had to be in, or else soap opera can't happen.
Yeah.
You know, you have to. So not only are they looking for writers that are good, but they're also looking for people that can turn a script round fast.
Yeah. It's exciting though when you get.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, when I was younger, I felt that happened a lot where I could stay up all night and something was buzzing around so much you couldn't even sleep anyway. Yeah. So you'd just get up and write through the night.
And we used to, you know, gather as a little group. So it'd be me, Jimmy McGovern, you know, Frank Cottrell, Bob Boyce. They're all. These are all great writers. Phil Redmond didn't know what he had, literally, as team writers.
Yeah.
And we'd fight like mad for our bit of script, and we'd say, no, he'd never say that. He'd die before he'd do that. Literally, there'd be fruit and breakfast stuff flying around the room. Everybody felt passionate about the characters, about, you know, Billy Corkill, about, you know, Sue Johnson's character. You know, he did have some great writers writing for him, you know. I mean... Jimmy McGovern's script were just amazing. You used to read them, you couldn't put them down. They were just amazing scripts. Yeah. And, you know, he's gone on and written fantastic things since.
Yeah.
But it was, you know, I knew when I was reading those scripts, I remember thinking, this man's a genius. And if any, you know, if you want to learn about writing, just pick up a Jimmy McGovern script or watch a Jimmy McGovern programme and you'll see a real master at work.
Yeah. And, what? So let's just quit. We haven't got too much time left, but... How do you think that we can address this kind of percentage of female? Because it seems to me like writing is, you know, it's so, you know, you've got to have empathy. It seems like a thing that that women are better at, really. Why is the percentage so small?
I think because a lot of the commissioners are men, and I think they tend to trust men more. I think there is a shift. I personally mentor six writers. Four of them, / five, are women. I'll take on, you know, a man if I think he's outstanding. Mm-hmm. In fact, you know, there's something at the moment that's about, you know, we're going to production soon with that. And that gives me great pleasure to actually bring up new writers and to get particularly the female voices through. You know, we had something which you can still catch, I think, on iPlayer called Overshadowed by a brand new writer called Eva O'Connor, who wanted to write about anorexia. Amazing piece and very, very topical. The other side of Fat Friends, you know, about young people that have got terrible illness, eating disorder. And I loved that. I got as big a buzz out of that, working with her, seeing her work come through, giving her a voice, as I do, you know, when I get a commission of my own. Yeah. You know, it's bigger and better, really.
Yeah. And it's not just a gender thing as well. Obviously, it's a class thing as well. In that, it's increasingly hard for in all entertainment, like, for working class people to be able to afford to spend the time in the way that the sort of Eton people have got their parents fall back on.
Yeah, you have to. Yeah. You know, it's like I did the same with Sally Wainwright. I feel obligated if I see a woman's script that's brilliant. I feel obligated to get behind it and to champion her. That's what I feel I have to do now.
Yeah.
But I felt that a long time, you know, for a long time. I felt that back in the day. I remember saying to Sally, you have to leave Coronation Street, because she was a Coronation Street writer. She went, and I could see that was a massive thing for her, because Coronation Street paid quite a bit of money, you know, and actually out there in the big wide world, it's frightening. But had she not left Coronation Street, we wouldn't have had Happy Valley. We wouldn't have had Last Tango in Halifax.
Yeah.
We wouldn't have had the great shows. So sometimes women have to get behind women, I think.
Yeah.
And because there are some men that, you know, that they're not all, men are not all horrible. There's some fantastic men.
There is some.
No, there is some. Because some men are wonderful at recognizing the inequality. And you know, you've brought this up, not me.
Yeah.
So you recognise it too, which I think is fantastic. But it does take women to champion women as well.
Yeah.
It really does. Men to recognise it, and women to get behind them, really. Yeah. Push them forward.
And but so much of it, I mean, and not everyone, there's presumably some K-Mellers out there who didn't get through, you know.
Yeah,
you know, so there's luck in it, but also
tenacity. You've got
it's that drive, isn't it? It's that desire to do it. And you see it in comedians, you see it in writers, because it's a very, very competitive arena.
Yeah.
And like you say, I think, I don't know if this is backstage or on stage, you said this, but if the person reading the script doesn't get it, you could have a brilliant script that just gets tossed to the wrong pile as well. So there's all these hurdles to get through.
Yeah.
But I think with writing, more than anything, that talent will be recognised, because you can't fake writing, I don't think. You can't fake being a good writer.
No.
You can occasionally, you can see an actor and go, you know, you've kind of lucked your way through to getting this career.
I can read a script and that and go, you're trying to be a good writer.
Yeah.
You know, you've learned about structure. You've learned about, you know, things like how to write stage directions. But you've not been able to tap into feeling. Mm-hmm. You've not been able to tap into... You have no real empathy for the character that you're writing, you know. And they don't need to necessarily be a good character. You know, I remember Sue Johnson saying to me, please don't make me a saint, okay, when I first started writing Brookie.
Yep.
She went, I'm so tired of being a saint. She went, it's boring to act. And I remember thinking, actually, wouldn't it be interesting to see the other side of Sheila Grant, which is what I tried to do. I flicked it to the other side. And I had a lot of, like, opposition in the room. They're going, but Sheila Grant's wonderful. She's there. I'm going, but she's also human. And we all come, we've all got the double sides to us. We've all got, you know, the darker side, the funny side, you know, the romantic side. We're all multifaceted.
Sure.
And you have to tap into everything.
Yeah. I mean, is that, I think that empathy for your own characters is the key, isn't it? That you're caring about the characters you clearly massively care about. The characters from 30, 40 years ago, you're still...
Yeah, I do. I love them, and that's what, you know, putting them on stage now gives them another life. And I love to see that. I loved it, you know, when I sat watching Fat Friends. I just loved it. I was sat there. And I would have done it for nothing. You know, I just loved sitting in the auditorium with the... With all the, you know, the audience there watching my characters on the stage. Yeah. I just loved that, you know, and they did too. And that's why, you know, that's what's so wonderful about theatre and, you know, as opposed to television. Because television's great, but, you know, I'm sat in my living room watching it and I invite round a few friends and we sit and watch it together. But it's so kind of, if I didn't do that, I'd be just sat watching it and go, well, that's the end of that. All that effort that I put in and it's gone like that. And that, you know, they pay you well, but actually you get to a stage where it's not about money anymore. It's never been about money for me, to be honest. It's always been about what I want to do or what I'm driven to do. And half the time, you know, if they didn't pay me, I'd still do it. Don't tell them that.
No. It's true of all of this. Yeah. Right, well, we're going to have to wrap up, I'm afraid, pretty soon. But I do want to ask you... what your feelings are on rhubarb before we go.
Rhubarb?
Yeah.
Oh, crumble with custard.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's... well, we're famous for it.
I
Yorkshire.
Know. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, no, I love rhubarb.
We're in the rhubarb triangle. We're in the capital of the rhubarb triangle. We're right at the clitoris of the rhubarb triangle now.
Where it's at. Yeah.
I love rhubarb crumble. Is nice.
Rhubarb crumble is just it's wonderful.
It is a sort of useless thing. Is it a vegetable or a fruit? I don't even know what it is.
No, it's a fruit.
It's useless, isn't it?
No, it isn't.
A load of shit,
gorgeous.
Hardly you have to put loads of sugar in it. It's poisonous, isn't it? Unless you cook it. It's the shittest thing I've ever seen. Do like a rhubarb crumble, though.
Yeah. Yeah.
My gran used to make a nice rhubarb crumble. Anyway, look, I'm so grateful for you doing this. And I know you've been just flown in and you've been absolutely awesome. Ladies and gentlemen, please give a massive round of applause. Hey, Mella! You have been listening to Rahalastapar with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, Kay Mellor. Thank you to Pest for providing the music. Thank you to everyone at the Theatre Royal in Wakefield and everyone at the Long Division Festival for their wonderful hospitality and having us here. Thank you to everyone at GoFasterStrike.com and everyone at ACAS. I've been indebted to my producers, James Hingley and Ben Walker. And thank you also to Chris Evans, not that one, for all the hard work he puts in. He doesn't get enough credit. This is a Sky Potato Fuzz and GoFasterStrike.com production. Go to rahalastapar.co.uk to become a member and find out more about these podcasts and see lots of lovely extras. Bye!
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
On Formative, middle school kids from New York City public schools interview a phenomenal collection of grown-ups.
Me, like, I don't know what I want to do.
You don't have to have all the answers.
I feel like a lot of people's favorite topics are, like, interest in their life.
That is a really good answer.
The podcast where the leaders of today are interviewed by leaders of tomorrow. Listen now at newyorkedge.org/formative or wherever you get your podcasts.
Thanks for listening. Go to gofasterstripe.com for all your Richard Herring download and book needs. Go to richherring.com/gigs to find out if Can I Have My Ball Back is coming near to you. And please listen to as many podcasts on this feed as you possibly can and make your family and friends and children and strangers, make them listen too. Do get consent from everyone before you make them listen, though. All right, thanks for listening. Go and listen to another one. Bye-bye.